AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 337 for July 1st, 2016. Dr. Data in a deep dive on the Detroit 3. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube. Okay, welcome everyone. Glad you're here. We're having a very special show today. This is me all mic'd up, and we're not just talking about that. We have three of the top journalists in Detroit who happen to cover the auto industry, all of whom are named Mike. So to my immediate left, we have Mike Whalen of the Detroit News.
Thanks for having me on as one of the three.
One of the three. His colleague from the Detroit News, Mike Martinez.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, Mike Elias of Automotive News.
Yeah, thanks. I feel like an interloper here on the mic'd up show with these guys. So glad to be here.
So what's also very interesting is the way that we have these three mics, and so we'll start in this order. So Mike Elias covers General Motors, Mike Martinez covers the Ford Motor Company, and Mike Whalen covers FCA. So we're going to get into that later on. So, okay, I encourage you, everybody who's on, to send in questions, and I promise to look at the questions. And this is a really great opportunity to ask these guys some questions. So to get to the news, the Volkswagen settlement this week, what do you guys make of that? I mean, the thing that astonishes me is how much money is involved. I mean, nearly $15 billion. I mean, What do you see happening as a result of this?
Well, I have 2 points.
Take it, Mike.
First of all, how many other automakers could survive nearly $15 billion in a settlement like this? This is, what, six times the GM ignition switch case?
Yeah.
Way more than the Toyota case as well. But second of all, nobody died yet in this one. People died with GM,
yeah.
Right? So I think it shows the importance here in the U.S. of green regulations. Right, it shows how hard the government's going to come down on you if you don't comply with some of their mandates.
Well, I mean, they also intentionally did this compared to GM. Like, I know we both covered the ignition switch stuff, which GM, there was some talk that maybe a few people in the company knew, but how high it went up, nobody really knew. For Volkswagen, it really seemed like top to bottom, or at least toward the top, people knew about this and they were intentionally doing it.
Yeah, I think it's the difference between willful deceit and just incompetence. You know, the regulators are showing that, you know, don't lie to us, don't try to pull one over on us. But, you know, is that delta between, you know, a couple billion for GM, who's killed a lot of people with their safety problems, or, you know, 15 billion? I mean, that's a pretty big spread.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it sent a pretty loud message.
You know, and one of the things I wonder about is that, okay, so let's say you own one of the 2-liter TDI cars, and so they're offering sort of a a la carte menu in terms of what you can do with this, and you can keep it, or you can sell it back to them, or if you have a lease, you can get the lease taken care of earlier. I just wonder what most people are going to do.
Well, I could probably talk about this since I'm a TDI owner. I could put my consumer hat on here for a minute. So I bought a 2015 Golf Sport Wagon 3 or 4 months before all this happened. And so basically my options are I can either sell it back sometime this fall, so this could happen pretty quickly, for, according to the court documents, somewhere between $27,000 and $30,000. And that number includes both fair market value pre-scandal, and then some additional, I think it's $6,000 or $7,000 for my troubles, right? Mm-hmm. And so I paid around 29. So it basically makes me whole, maybe even puts me a little ahead. I can't complain about that at all. I mean, I think that's, you know, more than fair. The problem is I feel like I'm probably like a lot of TDI buyers, and that one of the main reasons I bought it is because I hang on to cars a long time, and those diesel engines are bulletproof. And so I kind of want to
I don't want to get rid of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, the regulators are saying, well, VW is going to work on a fix. And, you know, if the fix, if they figure it out, they can fix your car. They'll still pay you the compensation and you can keep driving it.
So you'll still get the $5,000 or $6,000 or whatever that number is.
Right.
For your inconvenience.
Yes. But you'd have to, I'll have to wait potentially as long as 2 years to figure out if the vaunted engineers at VW.
Yeah, and that's great. We had a viewer, Ron Paris, wrote in. You know, what is the state of the fix that VW keeps talking about?
I mean, you know, I went through the 225-page document fairly closely because I have a vested interest in this thing, and it's not clear to me that any of the three engines. And I had the newest engine, and I kind of thought, well, you know, clearly they must have been cheating less as the years went on, you know? And I guess that's not the case, because it's not clear to me that they're any closer on that engine than they are the first engine. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least nothing in the court documents suggests that. So mm-hmm. it could be 2 years of waiting for nothing. Mm-hmm. But
So presumably, I mean, there's that other aspect of this whole thing of Volkswagen having to fund in California, I think, primarily the charging stations for electric vehicles as well as hydrogen stations. That ought to be making other car makers very happy that Volkswagen will be building out the infrastructure for them.
Definitely.
Did you hear anything from guys at Ford?
Haven't heard anything in relation to that, but it is interesting to see their new strategy, right? They kind of had a lockdown on the clean diesel thing, mm-hmm. and now it's a complete switch. What, 30 new EVs by 2025, I think the new vision is. So they got to do an about-face here.
Is it 2025 or 2020? I thought it was.
Might even be sooner than that, yeah.
I thought they were, I mean, because it sounded like it was, a 30's crazy anyway.
I thought it was 2025.
I thought it was 2025. Yeah. Let's say we'll give it up like Tesla does for its production just do that. mm-hmm. But I'm also wondering how many owners, Mike, like you said, before all this, VW cars were getting really good reviews with those diesel engines. And, I mean, auto journalists love them. Especially put a hatchback in a diesel with a manual.
Yeah,
He said he had the sport wagon.
Stereotypical auto journalist car, right? A diesel wagon. But, well, I think you kind of felt like the smartest guy in the room because you're like, well, it's fun to drive and it gets 45 miles per gallon on my highway commute. You know, it actually was too good to be true because the thing doesn't comply with emissions. So, I mean, they hadn't done the work they needed to do on it. The car doesn't, it right now, it essentially doesn't exist, right? I mean, you either are going to sell it back so you don't have it anymore, you're going to wait 2 years for a fix that may or may not hurt the performance and fuel economy of the car. So it was it was a bit of a mirage, really.
Well, and you look at recall rates right now for the completion rates, and the general consumer, I mean, it's white noise at this point, I really think, for a lot of the recalls. Mm-hmm. So once this fix does come 2 years down the road, I'm just trying to figure out how many people who keep these cars are actually going to get the fix, or how many general consumers are going to take the time, unlike yourself, to actually go through the documents and understand things while we, the media, educate them on what's going on. I mean, if you look historically at the recall rates and rebates, people don't necessarily do them.
No, that's true. But I think there's several thousand dollars.
It's big enough money.
I think you have to go get the fix before you get your money, mm-hmm. before you get the compensation that they would pay you. So there's a vested interest.
So, we're talking this giant billions of dollars that they're being charged here in the United States. I mean, what happens in European countries? I mean, aren't these people going to say, hey, wait a minute, you did that over there, and what about here?
Exactly. And I think that other shoe still has to fall. I talked with some folks in Ford of Europe, and they say so far they haven't seen a negative impact over there in terms of perception and mm-hmm. what people want. So I think they're still sort of ironing out some details there.
Mm-hmm. But if I were part of the German environmental organization or the French or the British or what have you, and if Volkswagen's selling cars in my country and they had the cheat device on there, I mean, I'm going to say, wait a minute, Why are you spending so much in the United States?
Well, Germany also started throwing stones at Fiat and saying, we test your vehicles and we don't believe that they meet regulations. And mm-hmm. then the Italian government stepped in and said, under the trade agreements, they talked to the Italian government that tests those vehicles, not the actual company. So they kind of came to the company's side. But, I mean, there's been a lot of other accusations out there since VW just on the American automakers as well as some of the globals.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't trust these guys if you're a government. I mean, they blatantly cheated. You can't trust them.
And the thing that I wonder about is that, get back to the 30 EVs as well as the fact of, oh, by the way, we have to make normal internal combustion engine cars, and we need to refresh these cars on a regular basis, and we need to build these things. I mean, that ain't cheap.
Right.
And so suddenly, if you're spending that much money, what's going to be the nature of these vehicles?
Well, I mean, I saw a report just today, I think it was an Alex Partners came out and said that diesel is going to account for 9% of sales in Europe by 2030. And right now it's 50%.
Right.
And that is a massive change for the supply base, for OEMs, for consumers, for infrastructure, I mean, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, clearly there's a lot of smart people out there who think that the diesel technology is sort of not viable going forward, not, you know.
9%? I did not see that,
yeah,
because
that's
I mean,
there's a study that just came out today by 2030. It's a prediction, you know.
But,
but that would be down from roughly half.
Right.
And
part of the thing, though, in Europe that the governments were basically facilitating the purchase of diesel vehicles by having tax policies that were beneficial in terms of buying diesel fuel rather than gasoline. And mm-hmm. so I think that number, you know, because everybody would always say, gee whiz, you know, what is the number here? Less than 5%.
Oh, yeah.
And so how is it possible that in Europe there's 50%? And you know, as you were saying, I mean, it's fun to drive. You're getting great fuel efficiency. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't Americans buy diesel cars, right? I mean, it
right.
just seems to be right in the sweet spot. And but when you look at the price at the state, well, I mean, obviously, gasoline now prices, who knows what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
But for a while, diesel was cheaper than regular gasoline.
Right.
But if you look at the European cities, though, a lot of them are actually enforcing EV regulations where they have these zero emissions kind of city centers where if you have an electric vehicle, you can go in there. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you have to pay a fine, not a fine, but you have to pay a fee to get in there.
Right.
So I think they're kind of betting on the EVs, kind of how the U.S. did with the federal tax credits.
And China certainly is, too. Yeah. So that drives a lot of you know, where suppliers and OEMs are going with their mm-hmm. future products. So, yeah. It doesn't look good for diesel right now, I would say.
So how does it look for VW? What do you think? Going
in
forward,
the U.S.
U.S. market.
Yeah, in the U.S., I think the identity you just tried to build for the last 10 years is up in smoke. So you got to start over. And that wasn't working very well to begin with. And they had a little niche going with, you know, probably a relatively affluent buyer base that now, you know, they've betrayed. And they have to figure out a new identity here. And, you know, that's a tough thing to do, as many American brands can point out. You know, once your brand is damaged, it's mm-hmm. hard to start over.
And that new identity, if they're going EVs, we see how popular those have been so far. So good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
And are they behind some, you know, Chevy with the Bolt? And, you know, they're starting their new identity already behind a lot of the
right.
players are going up against.
Not to mention their strength is the car market in the U.S., and that car market is dwindling as well.
Right.
So, I mean, overall, VW, I mean, was it 5 years ago they were talking about being the world's largest automaker? They're going to have all these very aggressive goals, and mm-hmm. now they've got to take a step back and look over their whole business operation, I mean, globally.
Right, right. So, I mean, there have been some people who have suggested maybe they would just simply pull out of the U.S. market. Does that seem conceivable? I mean, you have Audi. I mean, Audi's doing fine. I don't think Audi has been tarnished
right.
much by
no.
this whole phenomenon. You got Porsche. Porsche's doing crazy great. And just the Volkswagen brand goes away.
I can't see that happen. I think they're still a little bit too big to just completely pull out. I mean, I don't know, to be honest. I mean,
I don't see it either, but you can't. This is, nobody saw this coming.
Right. right?
So this is kind of unprecedented times for them.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what their top dogs think.
Right.
If I had to bet, I'd say no, but I wouldn't want to be the guy who has to go back to headquarters and draw up the business plan for how they make it work in the U.S. now.
Mm-hmm.
Even before this, their sales were one of the only automakers down every single month when you looked at the stats. I mean, It really isn't looking good for them. I can't see them just pulling out mm-hmm. that quickly. Maybe putting in new EVs, putting in more SUVs, and not talking about clean diesel at all.
that's very true. There was another shocker. So the J.D. Power initial quality study came out last week, and we didn't talk about it on the show. And I think it's
VW phone call.
Oh, we got a phone call about VW. It's not on my thing here. So.
This is Cliff Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. I live in a state where you have to have your car emission inspected. If it doesn't pass emissions, I can't drive it. How come they're allowing these Volkswagens who do not meet emissions to continue to be driven, for, like the gentleman says, for maybe 2 years? We'd like to hear an answer to that. Thank you. Bye.
That's a good question. I know it's different in different states. Some, you know, Michigan doesn't. You lived in Illinois. You had to take your car in every year. I think the regulators in this case, because it's an extraordinary case, have blessed one of these two options for TDI owners. You either will buy it back and basically, you know, scrap these cars, or you can wait it out for a fix. So I think, you know, it got the EPA's blessing, it got CARB's blessing out in California. I think that supersedes what would happen at the state level.
So in other words, you think that if he takes his car in and he has a diesel and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, it isn't hitting the numbers because of the cheat device, not...
It's a great question. I mean, you know, are they syncing up with all of the emission testing sites in all the different states? We haven't gotten that far, but I would assume they would be. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting question, though.
But I also think that the sort of testing that when they stick the wand in your tailpipe is not going to necessarily catch this stuff.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it was a certain calibration that was discovered that, you know, they were gaming the system. So
I mean, I think anyone, if any state were to do this and say you can't do this, it would be California or something like that. And if CARB agreed to it, that means already kind of settled.
Yeah, well, CARB's getting, what, like $4.5 billion out of this settlement. So I think that they're pretty happy about that. But so thanks for the call, Cliff. So this J.D. Power initial quality study, and coming out on top is Kia.
Okay? Shocker.
Yeah.
So Kia, Porsche, and then third place, another shocker, Hyundai. Fourth place, Toyota. Fifth place, BMW. So, okay, you guys cover this industry. Did you ever think that Kia would be on top in terms of initial quality?
Never.
I mean, no.
You take a look back to how many years has it been where they were at the bottom, right? They worked their way all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've had good launches. The product's solid. It's kind of neat. First time in 27 years, a non-premium brand has topped that list. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and I mean, I think back to the early 90s, late 90s, even mid-2000s, Kia was just kind of this brand that you saw, these little small cars that you expect them to be rusted out halfway through. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed when I saw the study come out. Micah Martinez covered it for us, but I was pleasantly surprised. And I mean, if you have been in their cars recently, they are nice. They're even from the entry level to kind of the K900 now, which is their luxury vehicle, they are nice vehicles to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're all shocked, I think, you know, we pay attention to the industry. We know that they've been doing a lot of good stuff for the last, you know, 5+ years. I think in the mind of the average consumer, just look at these as, you know, really budget brand. I mean, I can remember renting a Kia back in the early 2000s. I was out in California for something. I rented a surfboard, and I was, like, trying to strap it to the top of the car, and the thing was just denting like a can, you know? And, I mean, I think that's the perception of most people of Hyundai Kia. So, I mean, I think it's an absolute coup for them. If I was their marketing director, I'd be shouting this from the rooftops that we beat Porsche and,
Lexus. And, you know, it's interesting, I mean, that for the longest time, the Kia slogan was the power to surprise. And I mean, that just sort of says it all right there. You know, I find it also interesting to see that some cars that you might expect would have, you know, higher levels of quality. I mean, so if the industry average has 105 problems, to see Audi at 110, Mercedes at 111, Cadillac at 112. I mean,
the IQS, though, a lot of it, these vehicles that you mentioned, they've got a lot of new technologies in them.
Right.
And while they might say that they don't judge by
if something's confusing or a customer doesn't understand it. I think when you put new technologies in a vehicle, your rating's going to go down. We've seen that with other surveys as well, mm-hmm. because, one, they're not fail-proof yet. That's why a lot of the older model vehicles in IQS as well as Consumer Reports sometimes perform better than the brand-new models that you think, wow, this is literally the vehicle I want right now. But they've got to go through a lot of growing pains, particularly with the infotainment systems. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, transmission tweaks with the e-shifters and different stuff like that. So,
right.
I mean, Kia does have great technology, but I think it's a little bit more simplified than, say, Cadillac, Lexus, or any other kind of luxuries.
That's a good point. You mentioned the simplification. That's one thing J.D. Power mentioned this year. Infotainment and Bluetooth pairing and things like that continue to be the number one problems as far as tech goes. But they said the automakers that are making things more simple, streamlining these new technologies, are having the best results. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's interesting to note, J.D. Power said that new driver assist technologies, semi-autonomous features, have seen relatively low problems reported so far. Mm-hmm. So that could be a good sign moving forward.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of those, though, customers don't even know if they have them until they need them, like
right.
the emergency braking or forward collision alert. So I think we might see, this is just my own opinion, but I think as we go through the years, we might see a few more problems pop up with people thinking that they have them and how that they work. If they're going 80 miles per hour and then somebody slams on their brakes in front of them, that they're just going to come to a complete stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to happen. It might slow it down, but you're
right.
still going to hit that car in front of you, and then there's a problem right there mm-hmm. from the consumer standpoint, I think. And adaptive cruise control, a lot of the automakers that I've driven, if a car gets in front of you and just kind of really goes in there, I mean, the car almost completely stops
right.
at that point. And we'll see as more automakers install these and they become more standard mm-hmm. if they do become problematic.
Right.
I will say, though, this year's study, 21 of 33 brands improved. So I think, you know, Kia being number one speaks to the fact that across the board, it's been a good year. And you look at FCA, Mike, they're normally at the bottom.
Yeah.
Jeep and Chrysler, they improved the most out of anybody.
Yeah.
So we're seeing across the industry probably the best time for quality vehicles in a long time, if not ever.
But our friends at Fiat are second from the bottom. So, all right, we got to take a quick break here. We're going to hear a word from Bridgestone. So we'll be right back. And we're back. So before we leave J.D. Power, I mean, I thought one of the interesting things was that the domestics, you know, you mentioned rising up, and they won a lot of their categories. And I think that the people at these in these various divisions have to feel pretty good. I mean, compact SUV, the highest ranked was the Chevy Equinox, tying with the GMC Terrain. I'm sure people downtown were very excited about that.
Two older models.
Yeah, too. I was going to say that's an example of what Mike mentioned about how they've, you know, those have been on the market a really long time. They've had a chance to work out the kinks. But I think it is worth pointing out, and it's almost, I wonder, you know, if you took it just a look at the last 5 years of all these studies, not just the initial quality, because this is really looking at a very narrow thing,
right.
like 90-day window after purchase, right? But the domestics, well, Ford and GM, you know, dependability, reliability studies, the last 5 years, I mean, if you condensed everything, it'd probably be neck and neck, I think, with the imports. You know, at some point, this is going to stop being a story, at least in the people that watch the industry closely. I think that the perception among the just average buying public is, you know, that there's still this wide gap between mm-hmm. Asian brands and the domestics.
Mm-hmm.
Tahoe was kind of a surprise on there because that is somewhat of a newish vehicle,
yeah,
but I thought that was really
two
nice.
And a half years. Yeah.
Lincoln Navigator is still an older model.
Silverado came in for light duty pickup as well as for heavy duty pickup.
Ford's newer.
We got the midsize sporty car, Dodge Challenger. So
another old, yep, an
minivan,
older
highest ranked. Chrysler Town and Country.
Now the Chrysler Pacifica, and I'm guessing that's not going to be on the top of the list next year, to be completely honest. It's a great minivan, but a lot of new technology in that.
And it came in second here, Dodge Grand Caravan. Yeah. So I'm not even seeing Odyssey or Sienna on this list. Or the Sedona.
It's good to see that improvement because you look, you know, there's a lot of variation in these quality studies. I mean, you'll see, you know, sometimes there's not a whole lot of difference between the 8th place and the 15th place, you know, mm-hmm. but that's the one consistent over time typically has been a lot of the FCA brands toward the bottom. And so this was big for them, I think, in that, you know, if they have that going in the right direction, that's a big problem that they're hopefully fixing. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the Pacifica is their biggest launch of this year, if not even in the past few years, because of how much they dominate that market for the minivan. They're almost 50% between Dodge and Chrysler. So they have to get that launch right. And from what Tim Kanisius, the head of the passenger car, said last week, they're on track right now. It's ramped up. And people so far, I mean, I was driving one around and got compliments on me driving a minivan, and that has never happened before.
Well, I mean, I honestly think that perhaps the most important launch in the industry this year is the Pacifica, just because it represents such an important vehicle that is in, you know, one specific category that you can say, minivan. So if somebody comes up with a new sedan, it's just like, okay, there are a whole bunch of sedans. There are very few minivans that are out there. Now, Honda's supposed to come out with a new Odyssey a little later this year, so we'll see.
Sienna's due, I think, too, pretty close to being due for a redesign.
Yeah,
I think. You add the Google element with Pacifica, too. There's a lot of fun opportunities for that.
We'll see about that. we might talk about that a little later.
All right. So Strategic Vision, another consulting firm, came out, and they have what they call the Total Quality Impact Score. This is the complete holistic measure of experience that encompasses positive and negative product experience, including reliability, driving excitement, and other aspects of dealership experience. Okay, so basically they're saying the whole ball of wax, right? I mean, so you like it, this is technology, blah, 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 blah. Best model overall, that's very small print for those of you who are listening on the podcast can't see this, but if we were to see what this very small print says, the best model overall, Tesla Model S. Now, isn't the bloom off that rose?
Well, I mean, I think that shows you right there that this is a survey that really takes a different tact than the last one we talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, most of these surveys are, you know, you stay out of the service department and you're doing well. Mm-hmm. Model S has not stayed out of the service department. I mean, the list of quality problems with that car, I think, is pretty well documented. But I think what this shows is it's sort of an interesting approach because, you know, do you like the car? Do you think it's cool? Do you like showing it to your friends? I mean, that's kind of my take on this survey. Mm-hmm. And clearly Model S still has the cachet among its owners.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, the whole ownership experience you were talking about, Tesla takes, they do take very good care of the owners. They'll pick up the car for you, the over-the-air updates. I mean, I drove around Model S and that instant torque on there, even before the insane mode or whatever they call it, is great. But, yeah, I mean, Fiat Chrysler performed pretty well in this one, too. They had four top, Wrangler, Grand Cherokee.
Let's see. Wrangler is the entry SUV segment, mid-size SUV segment, Grand Cherokee. They've got...
But you mentioned fun, Wrangler.
Yeah,
people sure. Just fun, customize that.
Different. Isn't the C-Max Energy on there?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I mean, that's something like you go show the neighbors, you know, like I think...
It's because you could probably take every C-Max Energy owner and put them in this room and
put in one cul-de-sac.
How many have they sold, Mike?
Ooh,
about
not a lot.
I brought the C-Max up last week because I remember when they first came out that and they were touting the miles per gallon so much, and Al Mulley was so proud of that, and then they had bring it down because they weren't lying on tests or anything like that, but there was some sort of miscalculation with their MPG. And that vehicle just never took off like they wanted it to. I mean, you see a lot of them around here.
Too, right? The energy is the plug-in, so it's not even just the hybrid, because the C-Max is only a hybrid.
Exactly.
And the energy is the plug-in part, right?
Maybe it was just the hybrid that had the miles per gallon discrepancy, but...
It definitely was the hybrid, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about
can't remember the plug-in.
And the Fiat 500 came in as the micro car, so I guess to your point of it is still... It's a cute car you want to show people...
It's not quality in the sense of a lot of these quality studies, I think, in terms of, you know, low number of, you know, service visits and things like that.
Mm-hmm. The WRX, I mean, another one.
Yeah,
favorite of car owners.
Okay, but then looking there, so Toyota Corolla. Now, I mean, come on. I mean, it's. I mean, that I mean,
blows up
it's
the theory a little bit.
It's yeah. not. I mean, it's. You know, it's got the reliability. It's. You know, it's bulletproof. I mean, it's. You know,
50 years young.
50 years young.
Corolla owners do love their Corollas. My aunt had one, and they switched her to a Ford Fusion. She did not want to leave her Corolla.
Yeah.
And she actually ended up liking the Fusion. But I mean, they can be a passionate fan base. Mm-hmm. Maybe not passionate, but loyal. Let's say that.
Definitely loyal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. I think a lot of these studies, car companies become very happy about because they're able to say, you know, strategic visions, best, yeah.
best find one usually
best choice. So switching up gears here a little bit, there was the report that came out of BuzzFeed in terms of Uber drivers not making a whole lot of money, that. There were some leaked information in terms of what three cities, what these guys ended up making. And so I believe we have some of these images that we can show here. So here's Denver. After expenses, $13.70 per hour. Then we have in Houston, $10.75. And in our dear Detroit, $8.77. Okay, so here's the thing. There seems to be this notion that as we see car companies, I mean, Toyota just put a lot of money into Uber. We don't know how much. General Motors has put, what, $500 million in Lyft, yeah. right?
Yes.
That this whole ride-hailing economy is going to become more and more part of it. So if we've got guys rolling around who are making far less than minimum wage, is this going to last?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, right? Because eventually they're going to want to substitute those real drivers with, you know, robots. But second of all, how many of these drivers are doing this as a full-time job, relying on this as their primary source of income? I wouldn't say it's a large number. So if you're doing it on the side, right, or you know, if your spouse is at work and you have some hours to kill, so you go pick a few people up, I don't know how upset you would be with that. I would tell you, though, it's a sign of a troubling trend, because Uber touts this fact that you can make so much money doing this. In reality, you can't. And another study, I think, came out this week talking about how Uber is now tracking driver speed and driver performance, braking and acceleration. So if I was a driver, I may not be too happy with the company right now.
This is part of their safety initiative, though.
Sure.
They're trying to make it safer, so that's why they're tracking these things.
Well, and I think part of that, too, was spurred by that incident in Western Michigan a few months back. Yeah, the shooting spree by the Uber driver. You know, Uber took some flack for that, for not having some system in place, because that guy had, there was multiple reports of this guy driving erratically before that. So, I mean, I get the big brother thing, but I also think there's things that they need to do to make sure that, you know, to be on top of the safety mm-hmm. factor.
Yeah. But, I mean, ride hailing is not just going to go away. There's a whole generation now that are so used to just being able to pull out their app and hit pick me up.
Mm-hmm.
I think Uber, regarding the wages, they're just going to have to change their model a little bit maybe. But I know a few drivers, and they don't do it as full-time gigs. Mm-hmm. They might do it on the weekend, say down in Royal Oak on a Saturday, Friday night, get the peak hours where they get paid more.
Surge pricing.
And then, I mean, with Lyft, you can choose your tip, which is a little bit different of a dynamic than Uber. So Uber, you just get in and out, you're done. Mm-hmm. Lyft, you can pick your tip and go from there, but I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I think it's too convenient and too easy, mm-hmm. but they are going to have to change their business model a bit.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing that strikes me about these companies is you look at the valuation of Uber, mm-hmm. and you look at the valuation of, Ford, right? I mean, it's just like, what the hell? I mean, what?
I mean, put Tesla up there.
Yeah.
They haven't made a profit, and look at their stock.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what's up with that? I just don't get it.
I think Uber's still a private company, though, isn't it?
But
I don't believe they're...
Yeah,
they have a valuation. They've
been valued at, I want to say it's like 40, 50 billion, something.
Yeah, 60 billion.
But I mean, I think that's investors.
Talking Volkswagen money there.
Yeah, right. I think that's investors looking at growth prospects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you do have all the OEMs sort of throwing money at these guys to try to partner with them. But I do think that the GM Lyft Toyota with Uber, Volkswagen's got, I think, Get. In Europe. But, I mean, I think that those, I mean, they're in their infancy, but I think it has the potential to eventually start to change the model a little bit. I mean, this GM Lyft thing, like a driver can get into a car, they can drive and have rides without paying insurance. Mm-hmm. If they do enough rides, they don't even have to pay for they're renting on a weekly basis. And if they do, I think it's like 60 rides in a week, which is probably a lot, they get that wave. They don't even pay for the car. Mm-hmm. And so I think the OEMs getting into this is maybe you might see a little more standardization and a little more sort of professionalism around what now is sort of this grassroots feel of mm-hmm. you know, some dude picking you up in his PT Cruiser and
right.
You'll have in Chicago, Chevy's got like 500 Equinoxes that they have provided mm-hmm. Lyft drivers now, which is a really smart car to use, I think,
sure.
as a ride hailing.
And I believe they don't have to worry about the maintenance either
right.
when they're driving these. And I'd say 60 rides a week. I mean, that's, say, average 10 a day if you work, you don't work Sunday. That's not that much in a night. I mean, a lot of the Uber and Lyft riders, they go 3, 4, 5 miles. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not that much. So you go drop off, pick up, and you do that 4 or 5 times a night. You're already at 10. Mm-hmm. And that might even only be an hour and a half, 2 hours of your entire night. So I think what GM did with Lyft is great, yeah, actually.
I think it's a smart experiment to see if like it takes the expenses out for the driver. Now, if the whether it pencils for the rates make sense for enough to make more than $8 or $9 an hour, I don't know, but mm-hmm. I think it's a smart idea to try.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we've got a question here. This is sort of has nothing to do with studies or Lyft or Uber or what else we talked about, Volkswagen. Maybe this is a little more to you, but I know you guys are enthusiastic. What do you think of the mid-engine Corvette shown this week?
Well, I think shown is kind of a strong word.
This
is Jonathan 3.
I showed that, I forwarded that those spy photos to a lot of people who know a lot more about cars than I do, and none of the pros that I sent it to could say for certain if they thought that was a mid-engine Corvette. I would say this on this. I mean, I don't know enough about it to have reported on it. Car and Driver has some magic source on this, and they're usually pretty good. So I think that there's a lot of smoke on mid-engine Corvette. I think it could lead. I mean, I think for the rumor mill is hotter than it's ever been. I would not be surprised at all if Car and Driver's right on this, and we see a mid-engine Corvette. And I think right now there's more reason for Chevy to be looking at doing it than ever. I mean, this current Corvette has sort of reached that sort of supercar level, and you know, a mid-engine variant of it would kind of get them, you know, cemented in that sort of upper echelon of the, you know, Ferraris and Porsches mm-hmm. of the world. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would just be a variant, though? Because, I mean, we've been hearing scuttlebutt about a mid-engine Corvette now for
ever.
2 or 3 years, even yeah. before the C7 yeah, came out. I mean,
it's been a consistent thing.
Okay.
I think that's the biggest question, but, right, would you still have a sort of base front-engine Corvette? And I think, I mean, you know, it would be a lot more expensive to have a mid-engine, right? And so, you know, the calling card of Corvette has always been, it's this value play, and that's a heritage I don't think they'd want to walk away from. So if I had a bet, if this mid-engine thing is true, that we would see it as some variant, you know, halo car, and they'd still have a base vet for the loyalists.
Wouldn't they still have a new architecture for that then? I mean, because you can't just, say, take the engine out of the current one.
No,
just move it back.
I mean, because that's what I was thinking when you said variant.
Seats. They wouldn't have to worry about taking those rear seats out.
That's
so
true.
Just, you know, they got that space.
When you said variant, I just, it peaked.
Yeah, no, it's not off, no, yeah. definitely not off the existing platform. I'm just a different Corvette model.
Okay.
Completely its own animal. But I would think they would have to keep a front engine Corvette for the everyman who wants to get into a vet
to be able to buy a Corvette for
grand,
yeah, you know? 60 grand. Yeah, I think that this is just, you know, like Bigfoot sightings that, you know, you're constantly seeing Bigfoot, and
yeah,
one day Bigfoot will show up and we'll see him. And so, okay, anyway, we're going to take another break here, our last break. Then if I can find it, we're going to come back and we're going to have a number. We're going to quiz these guys with a number. So we're going to hear from our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. These guys thought they were just going to show up and we're just going to talk about stuff. And here's this list, and I want you guys to tell me what this list represents. So basically, just so you know, there's that dash in Toyota is at 17. And I'll give you another clue that there's actually 50 on the list. And these are the, you can see the two automotive companies on the list, Tesla and Toyota. So, Mike Martinez, what do you think it is?
Ooh.
There are no prizes, so you can just say whatever you want.
You know what? I need some more time. I think Whalen should go first.
Mike Whalen, you better not have the answer, because
the first thing that came to mind was most innovative companies, because I saw one with Amazon on the top, but I don't believe Toyota was in there. I think GM was in there, but I'll stick with most innovative companies.
Well, we know it's not profit, revenue, or market cap. And I wouldn't, you know, I thought maybe like brand strength, but that definitely doesn't make sense because some of those brands I don't even know. I would go with Mike, some kind of innovation. We're failing here, aren't we?
No, you're biggest global tech company. I don't know.
You don't know. All right, so you guys are right.
Oh.
So MIT Technology Review came out with their list for 2016 of the 50 smartest companies. And so as we were talking about strategic vision, how they define this thing in terms of, you know, what is a car you want to show your friends. So in their case, they define smartest companies as having innovative technology with an effective business model. Okay. But then we get back to your point about Tesla, sort of makes you wonder, but, you know.
I was going to say at number four, effective business model will... Still, still out on that.
And so then we have filled in here to show that Baidu is a Chinese web services company, and Illumium is in genomics, and Aquion Energy is doing saltwater storage batteries. So that's who those companies are. But, you know, it's very interesting to me to see that, you know, that is even the perception among, you know, the techie people who are at MIT Technology Review saying, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. And how Toyota managed to get in there, and none of the three companies that we talked about, we'll be talking about next, are on that list.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you listen to a Tesla shareholders call, the questions coming out of there from the tech industry are completely different than the ones you hear on GM, Ford, or Fiat Chrysler. And there's a lot more criticism on their business plan. Ford reports the record profit. GM reports the record profit. They asked to bring back Alan Mulally at the shareholder meeting. Sure. Tesla reports a loss, and they say that they're going to produce increased production fivefold within 2 years. And everyone's like, oh, well, how are you going to ramp that up then? And there's not a lot of cynicism to it. And one guy, I remember when they announced that, asked, I'm not very familiar with this ramp up, but, you know, how are you actually going to build the cars?
You make these things?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's different perspectives out there, especially when you get into the tech world.
Mm-hmm.
But
So let's move. Well, I don't want to say move away from the tech world, because arguably the companies in Detroit are more technologically savvy than they've been in many years.
Ever.
So given the fact that we have this great opportunity that you guys day in, day out cover these companies, I asked you all to sort of think about how the companies you cover are doing and what their opportunities are and what their problems might be. So let's start with General Motors, since it's the biggest one. So,
okay.
So Mike, what do you see as the strengths of that company?
I would say two right now. One is trucks, and the other is China. I mean, I think trucks, the full-size truck on the market now, Silverado Sierra has been out about 3 years. I think they're really smart strategically in doing that. I mean, I think the storyline for a couple of years there was that Ford had completely outsmarted GM, went to aluminum. GM's going to spend the next 5 years catching up. And I think this was a strategic bet on GM's part that we can get another 5 years out of this. But I mean, it's a new platform, but there's a lot of carryover from the last one. Brand new engines. They've been able to charge 4,000 to 5,000, or they're getting 4,000 to 5,000 more in transaction prices for these trucks than they were before, and they close that gap. I mean, that was the number one priority for the truck that's on the road now, close the average transaction price gap to Ford, and they've done that. And they didn't need a much lighter truck until, I think it's 2021, when the regulations for trucks kick in again. So they had time to do a lighter truck. I think that's what we're going to see in a couple of years when they come out with their next gen. So, you know, trucks between the light duty, Colorado Canyon has been a hit, and it has
so the
other
scrambling.
Yep. And the SUVs, they still dominate. I mean, the trucks are why they got to 10% profit margins in North America, which is what all the investors wanted them to do. So, and China, they just, you know, they've just got this freakishly strong brand in Buick for, you know, for whatever reason. The Emperor drove one or whatever, but it's like the third or fourth brand over there. Chevy's strong. They, even with slowing growth there, they switched to SUVs in the last year to 18 months, so they're selling more SUVs. They're starting to build Cadillac. So China's a huge advantage that, you know, doesn't get talked about. I mean, they're neck and neck with VW as the biggest automaker over there. So
what's their weakness or Achilles heel, do you think?
I would say it's Cadillac. So GM's president, Dan Ammann, likes to use this statistic. He says that trucks and luxury account for like 14 or 15% of overall global sales come out of those two categories, just pickups, SUVs, and luxury. But they account for 60% of the industry's profit, 60. And GM, you know, trucks, they get more than their fair share, but luxury, they don't. They get less because Cadillac's a weak player, especially, I mean, especially overseas. It's just U.S. So they're really, that's why they're spending so much, and that's why they went after Johann Denischen to try to build that brand. And they've got a big image problem that they've acknowledged, and they've got a big lineup problem right now, which is easier to solve because they'll have crossovers. They're selling one crossover, and some of their competitors have five. You know, it's a problem, and they'll start rolling those out in a couple of years, but this is like a historically great market, and every dealer you talk to is just pulling their hair out because they're missing it.
So, their opportunity up the upside.
Well, if they can get Cadillac going in China, that's one. And they're spending a lot of money to do that. I think connectivity could be a. I mean, they would put that in the strength category. I don't think I would do that quite yet. I mean, they talk about OnStar, and they've had 20 years of being able to talk to their customers with an embedded connection, and they've have a big head start with 4G broadband in the car. But I mean, you know, it's still, the message is still sort of your kids can play on the iPad in the back seat, and I think they've got to move beyond that. I mean, I think they've got to build on that platform and roll stuff out that is going to make people want to buy these cars. Like this thing where you can get a report card with how well you drive, and you can show your insurance company to get a break on your premiums. Like, that's the kind of thing. They've done a few of those. They need to do a lot more to stay ahead, because in a couple of years, everyone's going to have 4G in their cars, I think.
I was glad to see yesterday they announced cutting the price in half, basically, for the services. And it turns out to be a good deal, because I was looking at the usage of data that people have. You know, I think this is one of the things people don't realize, that when they get this feature in their car, they have to pay for it.
I mean, yes. Yeah.
It isn't like the engine that comes in your car. Oh, I got an engine. And I go, oh, 4G LTE. Oh, what's this bill?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're not going to get, I don't think they got a ton of revenue from those payments. So why not make it more of a selling point to try to differentiate yourself while you still can before more brands catch up and offer 4G?
So the biggest threat that's facing General Motors right now?
Really quick, one short-term threat would be their market share continues to fall, and it's a really tricky thing because they're doing the right thing by pulling back on rentals, which they will tell you about ad nauseum, that we're doing the right thing because we're trying to improve their brand health and our residuals, and so we can't be filling these rental lots. But it is, their market share is at sort of basically an all-time low, and when is this strategy finally going to start going in the right direction? And then I just think existential long-term threat is what all these OEMs face, which is, do you want to be the maker of the dumb hardware device that all the Silicon Valley guys put their smart software and innovation into? And that's, they and others are trying desperately not to become that, and making some strides. You know, I think all of them are, but that would.
Great. Well, so before we leave you, we have a phone call, which again is germane to the company you cover. So, Carmen, please bring that in.
Hey guys, happy 4th of July. It's Jonathan Brown calling with my question about the Camaro Z28 shown in spy photos this past week or two. Do you think those spats in the front, the huge spoilers in the back, are they way over the top? Can anybody use this car as an everyday driver and actually not be embarrassed to have all these things hanging on the car? Or is this the new style and I'm just out of style myself? What do you guys think? Happy 4th of July. Great show. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, but I'm thinking when Porsche had the giant whale tail, I mean, come on. I mean, how did that thing look?
It's a Z28. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's the ultimate track car. But I remember when they unveiled the last generation, and I mean, they ripped out carpet, they installed thinner windows, they took out the air conditioning.
Mark Royce wanted to rip the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the answer. I think it's a track car.
Yeah.
You know, if you want an everyday driver, I mean, you could do a Z28, but I think there's other Camaro models that
would. CL1 if you want that horsepower and but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I Z28. I take one any day of the week and drive day to day. Maybe not in the winter, but I think it's meant to draw attention. And I think the stats, obviously, those are spy photos, but I think they're just going to blow people away because the current car is doing so well that you had a Z28 trim on there, and wow.
See, I was just driving a Camaro, and you know, I began to wonder who buys Camaros. What kind of people buy them? I mean,
it's a younger demographic than Corvette. I've always been told.
Because they can afford to.
Well, right. Yeah, it's more affordable. Right. Right, but you know, you're asking what the psychographic is of a Camaro buyer. You know, I did not like the last generation Camaro. I just felt like it was, you know, and actually the new one is also impossible to see out of.
I mean, it's just
true.
Like, so you know, it's got all these wonderful features. I mean, it's just
I just think it'd be hard to live with day to day. But the new one much easier,
right?
And it's I mean, the interior is a lot better.
You've got the rear view camera though now too, that helps out. But yeah, when you're trying to actually look in the back and see out of those cars, I actually haven't driven the new one too much, but the last generation,
it was like wearing a motorcycle helmet.
Okay, let's move on to Mike Martinez and talk to us about Ford.
Sure. I think a lot of what Mike said about GM is going to apply to Ford, right? Strengths. Obviously, trucks and SUVs, right? This is kind of Ford's wheelhouse with the F-150 and the leadership in that segment for decades at this point. And you look at the SUVs, they've just refreshed or redone all of them within the past 2 years. Mm. You look at Edge, you look at the Escape, just came out, new front-end grille, a lot of new technology. So they're refreshing these products at just the right time. Explorer, about a year or so ago now, right when people are gobbling these things up. And the Escape's kind of their technology product showcase, right? I think they debuted a lot of their cutting-edge stuff on this vehicle. And it's, you know, it's got Sync 3. They kind of redid the front of it to include more storage space for folks, you know, younger buyers who want to throw a cell phone or other things in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're playing in the right spaces at the right times. But as far as weaknesses go, again, I'd look to the luxury brand, Lincoln, although I'd put an asterisk by that. There's some incremental growth. Right. And Waylon and I debate this in the office all the time.
I like to hear this debate, by the way. So go ahead and then bring your colleague in.
Ultimately, I think it is a weakness because same reasons for Kay. Like, you don't have a lot of product out there and you're just I think they're at 44,000 sales halfway through the year now. It's nothing. It cannot compete with the major luxury brands, although they're starting to define their own role, right? They're all about this quiet luxury, whereas Cadillac's going more towards performance. So they're starting to find their own way. They brought in Matthew McConaughey with all those fun ads to try to draw in a bit of a younger crowd. They claim it's working, and they're starting to put out better product than what they've had in recent years. You look at the MKC, the MKX. So you're starting to see growth in Lincoln, but I think still at this point, it would probably be a weakness.
Do you think Lincoln's going to succeed? I mean, one of the things that you hear a lot is China. Just as we, saying, in General Motors is,
and they are focusing on China for Lincoln, and apparently, from what they say, it's regarded as one of the top brands over there, and they're focusing a lot of their product, like the Continental is coming up, very spacious, elegant back seat, mm-hmm. right, meant for the Chinese market. So I think they're opening up to 60-some dealerships by the end of this year. So they're focusing there, going well so far. I think they'll succeed, but this is a very long-term journey. I think that's the term they use. So we're talking 5, 10, 15 years here. So they're playing the long game with Lincoln.
And will they support it in the long term?
Well, they have so far. And you look at Mark Fields and Alan Mulally, what they've done in the past. I assume you wouldn't do that then and then just give up on it halfway through their journey. So mm-hmm. I'd say that'll continue.
So just to the point of through May, Cadillac car and truck was 58,968. And also through May, Lincoln total was 44,488. So here we have a weakness of General Motors, Cadillac just sort of like eating the lunch of Lincoln. But
exactly.
I digress.
I think it was Michelle Krebs with Auto Trader who pointed out, yeah, they're doing better, but it's like going from 0 miles an hour to five.
Yeah.
You need to see more growth over a sustained period of time. Mm-hmm. Then if you look at opportunities for Ford, obviously the mobility space, right? Every Ford executive will say now we're an auto and a mobility company. What that means, we don't quite know yet, right? Whereas GM is investing in Lyft and they have a clear strategy, right? Even FCA joining up with Google and some partnerships that they're putting together. Ford hasn't really played in the space too much. They invested some money in Pivotal, a software company, and they're partnering with Amazon to have the Alexa, the Echo system, eventually installed in cars so you can turn on your car from your living room or turn on your bathroom light from your car while you're driving in. So they're doing partnerships here and there, but their mobility strategy isn't quite clear yet.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens. There's a lot of opportunity there. Mark Field says it's a $5.4 trillion industry that they're getting $0 from so far. So if they can take advantage of that, even in the slightest bit, that's a lot of money for them.
Right. And the threat to Ford might be?
Well, I'd say, and it may not, obviously, the same. You got to watch out for Silicon Valley and some of the players there. But I'd throw in a new little wrinkle here with this whole Brexit situation. You saw Europe with its first profit since 2011 last year. They're hanging on, I think it was $200 and some million, so a very small profit, but they were able to do it. Hmm. What happens now that the sales over there are supposedly going to tank over the next few years, at least three? They're already cutting some white-collar jobs, I think trying to save $200 million, announced a couple months ago. And out of any of the automakers when this decision came down last week, Ford was the most kind of forward about it, saying this is going to have an adverse impact long-term. Everybody else said we're going to wait and see the impact. Ford said this is going to be bad, and we're going to take whatever steps are necessary to make sure we stay profitable. So what does that mean?
Ford still has a footprint in the U.K. in terms of making stuff?
Engines.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you're probably going to see some job cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And can they sustain that profit margin that they were able to fight to get with all those plant closures and all mm-hmm. those job cuts over the past, five or so years?
Mm-hmm. Does GM make cars in the UK?
They have two plants there, one of which makes the Astra, which is like probably their most important,
yeah.
It's number two volume-wise, but it's their most important car over in Europe. So, mm-hmm. But they employ fewer people because there's a lot of engine production out of Ford.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so now FCA.
Fiat Chrysler Automobiles NV, formerly a lot of different names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy to talk about their strengths. They've got Jeep and Ram, and those are their two pillars right now.
Mm-hmm.
Jeep, you can launch Jeep anywhere in the world right now, and that brand recognition that it has, it sells. It mm-hmm. really sells. And Mike Manley last week was talking about possibly launching an A-segment vehicle for Jeep. So it would be, there's the Renegade right there. It would be smaller than the Renegade,
mm-hmm.
which 5-10 years ago you would think Jeep having a subcompact or lower
right.
was just, it would blow the minds of most Wrangler buyers.
Mm-hmm.
But they're being really successful with the Renegade, and not just here, which was somewhat of a surprise with how the sales have been going, but globally. I mean, in Brazil, it's selling really well.
Mm-hmm.
Latin America, and even in Europe, So Jeep is the strongest pillar, and I mean, it's why they're still around. It's the reason why Marchionne wanted them coming out of bankruptcy, and Jeep
Just for Jeep.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the analysts will continue to tell you that. And Jason Vines just came out with a book about Chrysler's purchase of American Motors. And Jeep has kind of been the savior brand for a lot of different automakers, including American Motors back then,
right,
and Chrysler, Daimler, Chrysler. And, I mean, Jeep, the Grand Cherokee, they can't build enough of. The Cherokee, which a lot of people were very skeptical about because of the design.
Modernistic look, not the traditional boxy Jeep.
It's selling extremely well. They've had, obviously, some problems with it, with the transmission, as well as the gear shifter. Well, the gear shifter is a Grand Cherokee, but it doesn't seem to be harming the brand itself.
Right.
And they have the Trailhawk models, where GMC has talked a lot about, we're going to try to go after Jeep. They have their new all-terrain, is it, for the Acadia. And when we asked them at the auto show, Mark Roy said, are you guys going to go after Jeep? And he, in a roundabout way, said, yes, we are trying to go after their share, because there's nothing iconic as the Wrangler with them. I mean, the World War II Jeeps, you think back to it, and the customization and the devoted fan base. So, I mean, Jeep is the global strong suit. They're building plants. They just are entering India. China is a huge growth market for them, for Jeep. And we'll see how that continues to progress. But Jeep's the number one, then Ram. Ram, obviously, pickup trucks. I mean, a Detroit automaker builds a good pickup truck. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But they've got a lot of innovations on there, including the air suspension. And they've really been trying to nip at, I mean, Ford and GM. They're not at that level yet. But they're highly profitable vehicles for them. And they are putting a lot of innovation into them. So we'll see what the next iteration kind of pertains to the Ram 1500. But they've got the Hemi engine in there.
Right.
Very well-known engine. And that's the third thing I was going to say was Hellcat. While they don't sell a lot of Hellcats, they're at 12% are Hellcats for the Challenger, which is more than double.
So this is a 707 horsepower engine?
Yes, 707 horsepower engine that they doubled production of. And despite them not selling very many of them, even if it's 12% and 4% on the Charger, I mean, that is a brand halo and even a company halo. You say Hellcat, and everyone knows what you're talking about in the industry. The Viper guys were jealous of the Hellcat. So, I mean, those three things, Jeep, Ram, and then their brand images and their leadership that they have, I think is a really solid leadership base, and obviously headed by Marchionne, who can be sporadic. But I think they've got a very good, solid leadership base, particularly here in North America.
Weakness?
Cars. Cars are obviously the number one. They're getting rid of the 200 and the Dart. They already announced that. And they've just had quality problems as well. And they've, I mean, do you guys know a lot? They had for decades. I mean, their quality and their reliability have not ranked well. While GM and Ford have been improving, they've been improving, but not as much. And I would also say they have a very large weakness because they don't have a Cadillac or they don't have a Lincoln to kind of compete in that market. Yeah, they have Chrysler, which is a high-end brand. They'll argue they have Maserati, but that's even on an uber luxury level. So they aren't making those profits like they could be for those luxury vehicles, which is why they keep adding higher trims on the Ram 1500 and a lot of their vehicles that they have now, so they can try to get those profit margins up for them. So,
right.
Yeah.
So what's their biggest opportunity?
Oh, wait, the weakness? One more.
Oh, one more weakness.
Technology.
Okay.
I mean, technology and electrification. GM's been investing in mobility. Ford's been talking about mobility for 5-10 years. Fiat Chrysler's just kind of irrelevant in that space at this point. They announced the deal with Google to do these 100 self-driving minivans, but we're not really sure exactly what that partnership entails. It really just sounds like they're providing the minivans. Google's going to install their technology, and then, you know, they might work on it together a bit, but who owns the data, how much different expertise they're going to get from Google compared to just them installing these on there. Fiat Chrysler really needs to try to step up their game with that. And the electric minivan is kind of their first step to that. But, I mean, Marchionne has just blasted electric vehicles for years now. And the 500e got an award for the best electric vehicle. And then the next week he said, I'm losing thousands of dollars every time you buy these. Stop buying them.
You know, and it's sort of interesting. I mean, you think about it. I mean, so General Motors certainly has been, you know, I mean, for years and years and years, whether it was working on the hydrogen vehicles or the Volt. I mean, now we're in second generation of Volt. They got the Bolt coming out.
The EV1.
And then, you know, Ford has long been electrifying vehicles in many ways. And you know, we were talking about the C-Max Energy before. I mean, it's, you know, maybe it's not selling greatly, but, I mean, they've got it. And, you know, it's sort of funny that once upon a time Chrysler, when it was Chrysler, was, you know, in the game. I mean, that they were really doing a lot of work in this area of having alternative, you know.
I was going to say they had the fleet of hybrid Ram pickup trucks, and I'm really not sure where those went.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about them for years, and then you'd see them on the road a little bit.
Right.
But I don't think I've heard one mention of them for a year and a half, maybe even 2 years, regarding what happened with them. But go back to opportunity, Jeep. We have not seen the top of where Jeep can go, because the Wrangler production, they're going to ramp that up. We don't know where the peak volume is for Wrangler because we've never hit it. And those vehicles are just such dedicated buyers that they're going to continue to come back. And the global demand for Jeep, we just don't know where it is.
So you don't think there's going to be Jeep fatigue?
I can't see it anytime soon,
no.
Especially with the SUV market, how it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they could slap a Jeep logo on anything right now besides a sedan. And
just one on the back of this chair, by the way.
But, yeah, Jeep, the global growth, I just don't think we know how high that can go for them. And Brazil is also strong. Even though that market has not done as well as many thought, Brazil, they're a very strong foothold there, especially with Fiat and Fiat Professional. And China, they were really late to the game with China,
right.
So there's nothing but upward trajectory there for them, too, as they localize more production there.
Right. Biggest threat?
Biggest threat? Being irrelevant.
Being irrelevant?
Yes. I would say because they don't have the partnerships, they don't have the mobility space and a lot of technology, and depending on how much money they have, I mean, to invest and reinvest, there's been a lot of discussion about them not having enough money to actually come out and redo all these new platforms, redo these vehicles, that if you don't redo your vehicles and you don't get into that mobility space, the Google announcement was great, but they've got to do more to be relevant in the future auto industry. And Marchionne put a lot of doubt in people's minds when he talked about consolidation. And throughout the company, I mean, people were wondering if what was going on. Let's do a hostile, let's merge with GM. Let's talk to Volkswagen or anything like that. I mean, just
Volkswagen is probably a little low on money right now, I'm just guessing.
But a lot of people were talking about Volkswagen being the perfect partner because they're so strong in the U.S. with their cars and they needed a strong SUV truck presence. That was before, obviously, the emissions scandal. But I think just being relevant and maintaining what Fiat Chrysler is right now, Mark only said it, there's going to be three global automakers, a handful of global automakers that are going to make it in this new world. And he feels that to be one of them, they need to be larger. So.
Okay. You know, the thing that I wonder about, and we're going to have to wrap this up because we ran over, is the fact that, you know, trucks and luxury cars, trucks and SUVs and Jeeps and trucks, okay? So this is basically, you know, what Detroit's sweet spot seems to be. Now, we're in a good position right now in terms of gas prices being low. I mean, what the hell happens to these companies if gas goes up back to $4 a gallon?
Well, we didn't talk about it, but they're all better at the small car game now than they ever were, and they haven't ignored electrification either. You know, I think to their credit, they're not making money on that stuff, but they've never taken their eye off the ball of investing in it, and I think, you know, that's gonna pay off. But right now, the luxury and the truck stuff is what's funding
right.
the stuff. You know, it's like donuts and broccoli, I guess I've heard someone describe it as, you know, you got to eat your broccoli and do all this other stuff because you know you're going to need it someday.
All right, so final quickly, Jonathan Three, who wrote in another thing. China announced it might stop making partnerships required to sell cars in China. Why the change of heart? And did China get all they needed and are now preparing for an export war? I mean, I often wondered about this, like whether China would just basically say, hey, guys, thanks for the technology. Now we're going to build our cars. So... Here we've heard everybody's looking for China, right? Lincoln needs China.
Jeep needs China.
Jeep needs China. Cadillac needs China. So what happens if China just says, hey, you know, we got our cars?
I mean, GM's got the biggest presence.
I mean, it's a I think all of the automakers are sort of overplaying their bets on the continued growth of China. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because I think they're going to shut it down and make it harder to do business over there. But, you know, you wonder with just how much government money goes into the economy over there. You know, we saw it with the stock market swoon at the beginning of the year. I mean, it can, you know, if China goes south, a lot of automakers are going to have to be ripping up their business plans. Mm-hmm. There's no question that they're relying on continued growth in China is huge.
Maybe you see a brand like Buick go away after that, right? They've placed so much on that market. And Lincoln, right, that would rip up all their plans, right? They hope to triple volume by the end of the decade, and they've said that China's going to eventually surpass the U.S. in terms of sales. So what happens to them then?
Mm-hmm.
It's not looking good. It wouldn't.
Well, on that happy note, we're going to end the show. So Mike Martinez, so they can find you. And you guys, we should give you guys a plug for your podcast. You guys do a podcast.
We have Mic'd Up. Every Monday, DetroitNews.com/autos. And then you can find it on SoundCloud and Stitcher and all the places you find your podcasts on.
Wow. Yep. So just, is it Det News or Detroit News?
Detroit News, all spelled out.
So you got to spell it all out.
.com/autos.
Or you can just type in Mic'd Up and
Mic'd Up and it'll come up. Yep. Okay. So, and your colleague, Mike Whalen, who from Detroit News, and not to be left out, Mike Elias, Automotive News.
Yeah, go to autonews.com, and we try to track the industry.
You guys do a fantastic job. I mean, it's quite amazing. So I want to thank you all for being here for this special Mic'd Up show, and I think it's been great. So next week, as we heard earlier from McCall, 4th of July, there will not be a show next week, so it will be not until whatever is the Thursday after next Thursday. So, again, thank you all for your time, and we'll see you again, and thanks for watching.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.